G'day, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Scouting Australia podcast, powered by Australian Property Scout Buyers Agency. I'm your host, Sammy Gordon, and today, guys, I am happy to welcome back into the studio from the dirty south, the dirty deep, Mr. Jimmy Ibrahim. Mate, welcome back.
Wow. Do you know how welcome many people back. You upset when you intro me like that?
Because I don't care.
We have, we have plenty of the good people, not only south in Melbourne, but in Sydney, but in Adelaide, in Tassie. So you basically...
Don't you talk about the Tasmanians,
you
mate.
Are just diminishing all of our lovely listeners from the southern states. Look, mate, you've moved good. To Queensland for 2 minutes and now you're a bloody Queenslander. Is that it?
No, the only issue I have is you. Everyone else is sweet. Mate, my home roots are in New South Wales. It's just your ugly mug, mate. You know what? Have I ever told you I have a problem with Melbourne?
No.
The first time I ever went there was for my hip surgery. So I literally flew in. Taxi to the bloody hospital, got surgery, two nights in hospital because they wouldn't let me back on a plane until I was on the third day, and then I flew home. And that was my only memory of Melbourne for like 5 years. So when I went back down, I fucking hated it. Like I didn't want to go. I just had this really like negative idea in my head.
Yeah.
All right. What are we here for? What's it?
Well, we are here for another Q&A episode, Sammy boy. And finally, you know, it does take him a little while, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes Sammy, you know, you got to really probe and prod, which he does enjoy.
With a cattle prod. I'll cattle prod you, mate. Bring you out of the farm.
We have the themed Q&A episodes. It started off really well with the cash flow ones and Sammy's run with it. And we want to talk about finance today.
Here we go.
So definitely not the hottest, sexiest topic.
Sexy brokers out there. What are you talking about?
Oh, there's plenty.
Nick Wilcox, good looking bloke.
Is he?
He's a man mountain. He's a big unit.
Bigger than Lukey?
I reckon it'd be like a Goliath versus Goliath battle.
Godzilla versus...
Godzilla.
Gorilla.
And you're like David. There's David and two Goliaths. That's you.
Oh, wow. I'll take one. Yeah. Who wins? Do you know that story? Do you want me to send you that
you
story?
You end up in a pretty bad way. That's all I can picture. They're big boys.
But anyway, we are talking about
big
finance.
Shout out. A lot of love to both Nick Wilcox and Big Lukey Chusin.
Big Lukey.
Love you, boys.
And Nick. Yes. But we are going to talk about finance.
So off topic. Let's keep going.
We're going to talk about finance, Hemi boy. So we've collated the Brains Trust, our producer. She's collated some of our finance questions.
Is that your
questions.
Word of the week?
No, that's Kelly's.
Okay.
Yeah, she's a lot smarter than both of us.
Definitely than you. I've never
definitely
heard
than you,
speak. You.
So let's kick it off, folks. Let's see if
let's
we can
go, mate.
Stump
let's
the
rip
bull
it.
Shark.
We want to smash this thing in 30 minutes. Yeah, I've got to get to the kebab minutes. Shop. It's about to close, mate. Let's go.
I told Sammy to keep him short and snappy. So.
Like you. Never.
All right, Ian, first question, cab off the rank. Ian, this is to you, Sammy boy. Ian.
It doesn't say Ian, bro. It's Ian.
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 Ian. It's got a nice ring to it. What is the correct setup, Sammy, of bank accounts of rental income expenses for investment properties?
Okay.
Would you use one bank account for all investment properties or separate accounts and offsets for each property? It's a good question, especially
with
you.
It's a good question.
With quite a large portfolio.
Yeah, so probably the easiest way to put this is all properties that are in personal name, I typically choose the largest loan that I have in my personal name, which I don't have that many left that are in personal, but I would choose the largest loan amount that is in personal name that I can have an offset on, and I run everything in and out of that. All rents in, all mortgages out. It's almost like an everyday sort of bank account. I run everything into that, wages and everything as well, because it is going to be the most active way to pay down, say, especially if we say the primary residence, you had it on P&I. Interest is calculated daily. So when you have that in there, the more you have in there, the more you're paying down both the interest and the principal side of things from that perspective. And even if you didn't, if you were rent vesting and you didn't have a primary residence, you might have it against your largest loan, or maybe something that's got the highest interest rate that's in your personal name. You might sit against that, which will lower your cost as much as possible as well. So from a personal name perspective, that's the way I always did it. It's not always set up with that. When it comes to trusts and things like that, just a very broad brush spokes, the way that I work all my trust structures is I have them all with exactly the same bank, and I have all my trusts. I have a bank account for each trust, and the properties that are in whatever trust, all the ins and outgoings go out of that one account. So, because otherwise it gets too messy. And that originally that's how I had it. And I had to go through a big cleanup because it was all over the place. Everything was coming out of everywhere and going in everywhere. And it was like a
I
won't finish that.
Like a Saturday night for you. Mate. So let's just say you had Sammy Gordon Trust 1.
Yes.
And let's just say there was 5 properties in that as an example.
Yes.
All of those properties, all the rental income and all the repayments would come out of that one bank account, Sammy Gordon Trust RS. Bank 1. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Just to make it super clear for the people out there.
Easy as.
Yeah.
Everything
which does
in
make
and out.
Sense. Yeah.
It does, man. And it makes it clean. Hmm. You know, and so then you can especially if like you're not trying to build a massive portfolio, maybe you don't need, you know, 5-10 trusts. Maybe you only need 2, 3, 4, something like that max, right? That's still getting to a pretty decent sized portfolio. Plus you'll have a handful in your personal name as well. Having that split like that and having it very clean will just make it very easy to manage. Because a lot of people ask me like, you know, doesn't it get like stupidly difficult to do it on that side? And it's not when you have them set up correctly and they're just going in and out of the same account. You think about that, if you've got 2-3 trusts, all you got to do is keep your eye on those 2-3 trusts, make sure they've got enough funds in there during acquisition. When you're going through consolidation, you're just going to see them, you know, piling up, getting higher and higher with the cash flow coming in.
If you had a primary place of residence and investment properties in your own name, would you always have the offset against your primary place of residence?
Yeah, 100%.
Yes.
Tell me why, Jimmy.
Well, because it's non-deductible, the interest repayments.
Non-tax deductible debt. If you're going to retire some debt, that is the first debt you want to retire.
Correct. So always have the offset against, I was just making sure you're listening.
It's also generally the only loan that you might have that's principal as well. So it's going to cost the most. So the more you've got on it and paying it off more quickly, the quicker you retire that debt and get rid of it.
Because people do get confused trying to pay off their other loans.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
100%. All right, Ian, I think we did quite well. Ian.
Ian. You can tell you're not Australian. Go on.
Oh, wow.
Go on.
He called me Mexican once before, and there's nothing wrong. I love Mexico.
That's an insult to Mexicans. I apologize to all Mexicans listening to this podcast. I sincerely apologize. Please keep delivering me tacos and burritos. I love it. Okay. And mezcal.
All
Let's
right.
go, Jimmy.
Question Mark. This is question number 2. Sammy boy.
Marky Mark.
How soon are you able to refinance loans? His current loans are with tier 2 lenders, First Mac and La Trobe. So how soon are you able to refinance loans to better rates, or should you wait for the growth?
Is the question more around rates to get away from those lenders, or is it actually to get equity out?
I believe his question is
rates. Yeah. Rates. So that's a serviceability question, right? So if you're with a Liberty, La Trobe, First Mac, whoever, I think you said First Mac and La Trobe, if you're with those guys, you're into third tier lending, and you're there because your serviceability is an issue. So until rents rise, rates come down, the serviceability algorithm gets back in your favor where you can refinance them away to another lender. It's just a question of when that sort of comes back around. That could formulate part of retiring debt, and potentially when you retire some debt, that might open up the serviceability to allow you to refinance back out. But the way I always look at it is a cost of doing business, right? Like if you're getting in, you need second, third tier lenders to get in to do more deals, then that is the cost of doing business, and a slightly higher interest rate comes as a cost to that. Mm. That's just part of the process. You know, you're paying an extra an extra 1% on your interest rate, but you can get an extra $1 million worth of debt. It's an extra 10 grand a year. It's not the end of the world. You think about it, you can get $1 million worth of property and it goes up just by 10% that year, you're up $100,000 for the cost of an extra 10 grand worth of debt in terms of interest repayment. So every day of the week, I would take that on. But yeah, man, it just really comes down to the algorithm. When you get the debt low enough, serviceability strong enough, to be able to refi it back out.
And
there's
also
no set time. It all comes down to when that serviceability comes back in your favor.
And also, should you be considering that conversation with your broker, that which lender is going to be better for you buying further purchase down the line? So don't make a short-sighted decision to move when that potential lender that you're with, you might be paying a slightly higher interest rate, but they may be more open to lending you more as you go.
Yeah, one of the biggest things. No, it doesn't really work. It doesn't really work so much like that. It's.
But I'm just trying to get people to think a few more steps down the line as opposed to just.
Man, all it comes down to, if you want to build a big portfolio, you need to be with the correct broker that can set you up properly, put you with the right lending that you can just keep moving forward, right? Mm-hmm. Like the correct broker will work this out for you. I learned in COVID that rates really didn't matter. If you bought the right property in the right location at the right price, rates don't matter. So I don't give a shit about rates. If I can get the money from the right places, that's what I focus on, rather than trying to worry about, is something 0.2% cheaper or 0.5% cheaper? It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter in the scheme of things, because it is such a tiny variance in the whole scheme of things. Like before, talking about 1% difference in the cost of debt and the cost of interest compared to getting a significant growth run. Mm. That example before, I said 10%. so much of what we produced over the last couple of years, most people are seeing 20 to 30% worth of growth. So imagine paying or not paying 1% extra, which is $10,000 a year for every $1 million worth of debt. And that $1 million worth of debt, which could be 1.2 million of property or whatever, but even just say $1 million worth of property, if that went up 20 or 30%, $200,000-$300,000 worth of growth in exchange for 10 grand. It's a moot point. It's not even worth discussing. In my opinion, it's not even worth discussing.
Okay. There you go, Mark. Straight from the horse's mouth. Question number three, Jackson. Can you, Sammy boy, can you utilize offset accounts when red investing to have accessible capital while still reducing the principal and overall interest repayments?
Offsets don't reduce principal. They offset the interest that you would pay. So it actually lowers the cost of interest. If it's a P&I loan, that's the only difference. But if you're rent vesting, I personally wouldn't be doing principal and interest repayments. If you're rent vesting, I would be doing interest only and keeping my cash flows as strong as I could, especially during accumulation phase. When we turn to consolidation, that can potentially be a different story. But during that period, that's where you typically want to focus on keeping cash flows as strong as you can, keeping repayments as low as possible, keep things on interest only. And yes, you'd like to, I think this is answering the question, like you can definitely still sit money in offset. If you have, if you're rent vesting and you have properties, if it has an offset account or a redraw facility, you definitely can utilize that and still sit it in there while you're, you know, saving up for more deals or whatever. You can equity release into things like that as well. So yeah, for sure.
Okay, great. Well, there's your answer, Jackson. Moving on, question from Liam. And we're flying through these, Sammy. You're smashing doing really well. He's called you the Silver Shark, Liam.
The Silver Shark?
Yeah, he's called you the Silver Shark. And he's called me the Gold Dog.
Gold Dog. I'm looking right here. There ain't too much gold going on. There's a lot of silver.
Liam has said, I've just signed on and waiting for my first property with you guys.
Love it, mate.
Well done, Liam. My primary place of residence is still in the midst of its growth cycle. Okay. My partner and I are looking to rent vest, and I want to make our first investment and primary place of residence both into rental properties.
Okay.
So should we be looking to set these up with interest-only finance, Sammy boy? They have plans for kids in the next 18 months, so want to smash into as many deals as they can before they take a back seat for a little while. He loves the show, and he says, thank you very much. So that's from Liam. So the big question really was around...
So he's saying he's turning his primary residence into an investment?
They want to rent vest. So they've got the primary place of residence and one investment property.
Yep.
They want to rent vest and they want to, they're asking, should we be looking to set up the loans or the interest on those two properties?
As interest only or P&I?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm always a big believer in interest only, like we literally just went through in the last question as well. I think the thing to, and I know he said it's going through its growth, still going through a growth cycle. I would just be very sure of that, you know, that thing is still going to grow. Because typically when it comes to something that would have been a primary residence and now we're turning it into an investment, that is one of the most common mistakes I see people make out there is turning a primary residence into an investment, because so often it's not in the right location, you know, and if it's had a good growth cycle, you can sell it and pay no CGT, considering, you know, if everything has been set up correctly from that front. But it typically makes more sense to offload that thing and recycle both the debt and the capital into other deals rather than hold typically what's an underperforming investment. So I think this is one of the things here for Big Liam to have a look at and have a consideration around is it actually the correct asset to hold longer term? Being very objective about it. And if he is objective and it still works as a good investment, that's great. I would just kind of take things into equation here, because it might be that they want to rent vest for the next 18, 24 months until they start the family. When they start the family, they want to move back into it. And that's a different conversation, obviously, around that as well. But it's one of those things. If they just did it and it's grown and then it's finished and then they are just going to rent it, you know, from that side of things, I'd just be having a really good close look to make sure it is going to continue to perform and not be a substandard investment in the portfolio.
Because clearly they've got an 18-month window that he's looking at when they want to start a family. So if all things being equal, if they wanted to go as aggressive as possible, as he said, and the primary place of residence wasn't going to grow, then would it, I mean, we're not giving advice, but it's fair to say it would be better
you would assess the situation, whether it's worth holding that asset or not, right? But obviously everything we say in this body is not financial advice. So you got to obviously assess the market properly, chat to your financial advisor, all the rest of it. But yeah, man, it's one of those things. You want to go as aggressive as possible. You need to run your serviceability, see how much you got available, still holding that property, and then yeah, just create the best game plan forward from there. But reinvesting is a great strategy to keep costs down as much as possible and keep investing as hard as you can from that side as well. So okay. Yeah, I love it as a strategy. It's just got to be, I guess, applied correctly yeah. and fully assess the portfolio as well.
All right, well done, Liam. Well done for coming on board. Peter has written in, hey legends, in your experience,
g'day, Pete.
How long is too long for a pre-approval to be acquired from the broker once documents are signed? Right, that's the first part of the question.
Okay.
Is it a red flag if the loan proposals reduce significantly by the time the actual pre-approval is signed?
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a bit more.
Okay.
So, for example, the pre-approval was supposed to be $700,000 and it dropped to $550,000 to $600,000 mm-hmm. when signing with vague reasons given.
Mm. Okay.
Do you just go with the flow using the pre-approval or try to revise the pre-approval to bump up the borrowing while the asset is still being sourced?
Yeah.
By APS, of course.
Oh, beautiful.
So, what do you think?
Okay, there's a loaded question. There's a lot in there. First things first, this is why we always get people to get pre-approvals before we go source for them at APS. Mm. Because brokers tell people one thing, 700 grand, and then it comes back at 550. That's why we get pre-approvals done. So for anyone that's ever asked or ever thought about asking, well, why do they need a pre-approval before they go on source? It's because of this. A lot of brokers get their numbers wrong. And also, a lot of the time, you may have undershot something or not included something in the numbers that you sent them, and then the bank asks for it, and then they go, oh, well, that wipes 100 grand off your servicing. Hence why we always ask for pre-approvals, because it's never a guaranteed amount. Just because someone runs a servicing, we run their scenario to figure out exactly where it's going to come out on the back end. So that part of the equation is like, I wouldn't say it's a red flag. It's just something that like something has been missed there, whether it was by you not disclosing or the broker missing it, or the bank just having more policy, you know, more questions around the policy side of things as well. In terms of the servicing, yeah, I mean, that's the servicing number coming back. I would say if it's taking a while for it to come around, there's obviously a few things that have either been missed, you know, either by the, more than likely by the broker that have been sort of missed, or maybe they're waiting on something from Premurin. Sounds like maybe not. So it's kind of one of those things where I don't know who the broker is, right? So I don't know the way it works, like who it is that they're working with as well. But then there's the other flip side of it depends on which bank you've been aligned with. So if you're, and this is where I'm not going to make a comment specifically on the broker, because if you're a business owner or something like that, or you've got a different lending situation and you had to go with a different lender for a specific reason, turnaround times can be longer. If you're a straight shooting mainstream lending individual and very, very easy, pre-approval should be very quick. They should be able to run your numbers pretty quickly, pretty cleanly, pretty easily. But if you're outside of that box, there can be a lot of variances. So that's where one of the things of like, Pete's given us a scenario of what's happened as the broker side of things. We don't probably have so much of the backstory. So it's hard to know without knowing who the broker is and the exact circumstance around it as well. But I mean, it's always a little bit of a red flag. You get told an amount and then it comes back, you know, significantly lower, especially if you did give all the correct information that he's asked for as well. So something to be a little bit wary of. What was the last part of the question?
Well, just do you just go with the flow using that pre-approval amount of say 550 to 600, or do you try and revise the pre-approval to bump up the borrowing?
Well, something that has been submitted within the application hasn't stacked up. So it was 700 at a certain amount, but then when the numbers have actually been run, it's 550 to 600. So no, you would run with
unlikely you're going to get the 700.
Yeah, 100%. Right? Yeah, like it sounds like that was the numbers that were originally run, but that's not what you can actually get. So I would focus on, if that's a pre-approval that's come out, that's a pre-approval that I'd work with.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I just go with that.
And just going back to your point about for clients. So clearly when clients come on board with us, they don't have to have the pre-approval by coming on board. It's just when we start sourcing the deal with them, right?
Yeah.
Because when they come on board, we then can help them
100%.
Get finance.
If anything, we always prefer to put with our brokers if possible, because it's people that we work with and they work with a lot of our clients. And that means you're not just a small fish in an ocean, right? Which a lot of people can be at big brokerages and big accounting firms and all the rest of it. We literally put our clients with people that we want them to work with. There's no kickbacks on our end. You'll see there's no disclosures for anything from that side. we literally put you guys with who we want you to work with for finance, that we know if a deal happens at 10 p.m. on a Friday night, we can call them and get an answer if there's something that needs explaining or you know, we need any sort of clarification on that end. That's why we like it, because we have that relationship with those brokers. And we also know that they're top tier and they're going to give you the service and you know, and the borrowing that we know, you know, and the scenarios that we know that you need as well. So yeah, man, it's very, very important on that end. And yeah, realistically, I prefer it if a client doesn't come through with an existing pre-approval and we can put them with someone that we work with.
Yeah, great. Fantastic. All right, let's move on. The next question is from Mr. I'm going to call him CB.
All right, CB Radio.
Questions for the podcast.
Big four, buddy.
He's been doing that the entire day, everyone.
I asked for it as like a thing, like a button on the potty, but we haven't got it
yet. He wanted to say it after every question. So would you like to say, you've left a run late. We've missed out on four questions.
Mean what?
Hi, team.
Are you trying to make a joke?
No, Sammy. It was just
Go on.
Question. How much cash should I hold for each property as a buffer? If you can provide a range, i.e. bottom end for aggressive growth and top end for conservative growth.
Okay.
Now, he's given – that's the first part of the question.
Okay.
CB has said, we've been running the 20% deposits as we've had enough cash to do so to date for our initial four purchases. Okay. We still have enough cash to continue with 20% deposits for the next two or so. However, Sammy, should we consider 12% deposits or should we stick with 20% deposits? Mm. All right. He says, I know the overall benefits of 12% deposits. However, with holding costs, cash flow impact in the current market or current interest rate environment would surely not be as ideal just to de-risk.
Okay. So what's he asking about with buffers though?
Well, like, the first question is how much should he hold in a buffer? I think that's just maybe that's a standard.
And then about 20% and then the 20-12. Okay, so the easiest way that I look at, I'll start with the 20-12s first, right? If he has enough deposits to do four deals at 20% and then he's got enough in the kitty for two more deals at 20%, he's got six deals in the portfolio that he has acquired at a 20% LVR. By the time he's bought the last two to round out the six, he's going to be able to go back to the first two or four and pull equity out of those to keep moving forward as well. I know he's obviously bought with us, bought a discount, bought in the right areas. He's going to have equity that he can pull out. For an investor at that level with that amount of capital that he started with, I never recommend those style of investors start with a 12% deposit. 12% deposit is great if you have limited capital and you're trying to build very hard, right? Or quickly. And when I say limited capital, it's always dependent on the individual. If you just want to do one deal a year, 150 grand is probably fine. You do a 20% deposit on something plus closings plus carry a, you know, 20 grand buffer on something, you're sweet. But if you're wanting to push really hard, 150 grand is limited capital. You get two deals in, refi. And it always depends on what the individual wants to do. But if you've got enough capital to go hard with 20% deposits, I just run 20%. Like 12%, yeah, they're great for when you're starting out, when you're trying to stretch capital as far as you can, but mitigate mortgage insurance and still have a decent rate. Like they're great from that side. But when you've got the capital to play in the game of 20% deposits, at the moment, interest rates are between about 0.8 to 1% cheaper with 20% deposits, you know, 80% LVRs as opposed to 88s. You're also not paying LMI. So, you know, for every deal, even though your LMI at 88% is a lower amount, you're still probably saving four, five, 6 grand depending on the purchase price. And then you're saving 1% interest per deal that you're doing as well from the 80% compared to the 88s. So in the Big CB Radio's equation, I would be doing 20% deposits, 80% LVRs. And yeah, if it was someone in a tighter position and they were wanting to go hard, that's where we start to, that's where we push the envelope and you run it a bit harder at the start. You got to, like if you want to scale and push the thing really hard. I started with 90s to 95s. I didn't know about 88s at the time. I wish I did because I would have gone into 88s. But 95s were like when I really had to stretch the, you know, I was making at the time 40, 45 grand a year. My deposits were really, really low. And it was enough that I could do a deal. You know, I'd make 10% on the way in, force a bit of value. I could pull my entire deposit back out. Deal stayed positive cash flow and I'd roll into the next one.
Is there an argument for CB that let's just say he had 20% deposits to do two deals, but if he stretched himself a little bit, wanted to be a bit more aggressive, he could do at 12% maybe three deals. Or would you do the three deals at 12% or would you do the two deals at 20%?
In that scenario, I would do three But he isn't in that scenario because he's bought four deals at 20% LVRs at the back end of last year, in the last 6 months of last year. He's got heaps of equity in those deals.
So you're
deals.
Saying he can still be aggressive by recycling equity on the...
If I was him in this situation, I'd pull the trigger on two deals at 80% LVRs, get those deals under contract, go back to the first four, value them all, pull out the equity, roll into the next two at 80% again, or 88. Maybe you stretch those ones, but these two don't need to be stretched.
Okay.
If there was another person in a situation of they had enough for two at 20% deposits or three with 12, 88% lens, I would stretch into the three.
Starting out.
Yeah. If you're in that early accumulation, then yeah. But this guy, obviously, big CB, he's not in that scenario.
Okay. And the buffers per property?
Buffers.
Low range, top range?
Yeah. Again, it depends. Buffers are so personal, right? So it really comes down on how much you make. What are you buying? What's the yield on what you're buying? What's the condition of what you're buying?
What buffers do you have?
Mine's very different. I have a 50-plus property portfolio, so my buffers are very different to the average person. When I started out, I found $5,000 per property was good until I hit 20 at four properties, and then I stayed at the $20,000 until I hit about 10, and then I bumped it up about $20,000.
Per property?
No, in total.
Oh, total.
Yeah. So I did $5,000 per property.
Yeah.
When I had four properties, that meant I had $20,000.
Yeah.
And then I just kept $20,000 buffer until I got to about a 10 property portfolio.
Okay, yeah.
And then I lifted it up a little bit after that.
Okay.
But I flew pretty close to the sun. For the average person out there, it really depends, like exactly like on the cash flows of the portfolio, what's their income levels. If they've got really good incomes and they can save, but this is their first deal, they might fly a bit close to the sun and leave themselves, I don't know, $5,000-$10,000 in the bank, right? If it's their first deal, to really stretch into the best property possible and as much cash into it as they can deposit-wise to help them with the purchase price. But because they earn so much money and now they've turned into a savings machine, they're going to replenish those buffers really quickly. So it's not something you'd worry about. But if you're a lower income earner and saving isn't your strong suit because you don't make enough, maybe you're about to do your first deal, maybe you leave a $10,000 buffer, you know? So your buffer's there, your buffer's sweet. You know, you focus on getting a really good discount in a really good market, and then in 6 months, you're going to have the equity to pull out and go again. But the buffer stays the same. Buffer doesn't get touched from that side.
If you've only got one or two property, and again, this is just hypothetical.
Theoretical.
If someone says, oh, look, I got $50,000. I just want to keep a $50,000 buffer.
Yeah.
What would you be saying to them?
How many properties they got?
One or two.
I think it's massive overkill. I mean, everyone has
to have...
You mean
wasted opportunity?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Overkill of the size of the buffer. But it's always relevant to the individual person's circumstance. They got to sleep at night, right? I could sleep... I nearly got to zero. Like when I had like four or five, I got to seven properties. I nearly went to zero in the bank account because I pushed it that hard.
Too many kebabs.
Too many kebabs, bro. Too many snack packs. No, I was living off one kebab a day. Like it wasn't enough kebabs. But what I'm saying is... It's always relevant to the individual. Yeah. So someone's got a family and they're rent vesting and, you know, and they go buy their first property, maybe to help them sleep at night so they do not have to think about it. Maybe they keep $50,000 in there. I've had some people say they want to keep $100,000 in there. They live at home with mum and dad and they make, you know, $100,000 a year or something and they want to leave $100,000 buffer. And I'm just like, that just doesn't make sense. Like that's someone's fear mongering getting into their ears. Mm. But it's always relevant. It's always relevant to the individual. And I think people just have to be realistic with what they crunch in their own living expenses and their own cost of portfolio, type of properties they have in the portfolio, what's the yield and the cash flow, be it positive or negative in the portfolio. It's got to assess your own position. It's one of those questions that's not as easy to answer anymore because it depends what you've got and what you're acquiring.
Okay, great. We've come to the last question. We're nearly under 30 minutes.
There we go.
We're keeping tight here. This is Anon's back.
Anon.
Can you believe it?
Which Anon? Anon John?
The Don.
Anon the Don.
It's Anon the Don's written on my sheet here, Sammy boy.
Donny Bradman.
Dear Bull and Dog.
What is it?
That's the start of the-
Bull and Dog.
Dear Bull and Dog.
Oh, you know how I'm going to take that? A bulldog.
That's
I'm
going to
take the bulldog.
The question, I should have read this one first, but the question-
Probably.
Increasing PAYG income to borrow more. At what point is it worth it versus not worth it due to paying more tax in your job?
Okay. So Anon the Don.
That's from Anon.
Should he earn more money and pay more tax?
That's what he's asking.
Or should he earn less and pay less tax?
Because he doesn't like paying the tax.
Anon the Don.
He's used to dealing in cash. So
in cash.
Poor Don. Yeah. He's not used to these high tax rates, Sammy.
So, mate, if you want serviceability, it is a cost of doing business. You should be doing everything you can to declare as decent a wage as possible, so you can borrow as much money as possible and look as favorable to the banks as possible. If you're trying to build a portfolio, that's very, very important. We see a lot of investors, business owners, people that come through and they're wanting to save, their accountant's trying to save them as much tax as possible, but so they're making their incomes look really, really low, but then we are not able to get borrowing to then help them build a portfolio. So they have to wait almost like a full year to get their financials back to a healthy level at the end of tax time, so then they can actually get borrowing to keep going forward. When you're in heavy accumulation, it is critical to declare a decent income, as it depends on how much you make, but especially for the average Australian, you should be trying to increase that as much as possible, because the more serviceability you have, the more that you can save up as well. Yeah, the more borrowing capacity you have, the longer you can play the game and the more that you can push this thing. The less you have, all right, you pay less tax, but like, it's such a simple person's mindset to go, I'm gonna make as little as possible or not much, so I don't have to pay as much tax. Mm. It just means you're making money. You know what I mean? Like it means you're making profit, or you're doing the right things. The more tax you pay, the more you're earning. Yeah. And that's exactly what you want. So especially in heavy accumulation, is one of those things you wanna really focus on earning as much as you can, almost declaring as much as you can, so you can borrow as much as you can and keep stretching that journey as far as possible, so borrowing isn't an issue for you.
It is crazy how I've noticed that people have changed on the phone calls. A lot of people are understanding.
I've noticed that about you, Jimmy. You've changed.
That they should be declaring more money.
You've changed.
Understanding. He's come to the end. You're hanging in there.
It's been a long day. It's been a big one. I've been a larrikin today.
But the game of winning is accumulating. And if anything is going to hamper your ability to accumulate by trying to save 10, 15 grand in tax, you are just not going to ever win. Mm. I always use the sporting analogy. It's like trying to win a game of footy or soccer or whatever, but never trying to get scored on.
You just don't want to win.
You don't want to score.
Yeah.
You'll never win.
Mm.
And in our game in property, winning is accumulating.
Yeah.
The more you earn, the more you declare, the more you can borrow, the more you can buy.
Yeah. 100%, man.
So you, everyone needs to get this. I did this wrong for so long. And I know we've spoken about this before, but I did this for so long. Because my accountant was wrong. He was a share accountant, loved shares, didn't know anything about property, said, no, we've got to cut that. We don't want to pay more tax. So didn't declare any money, couldn't borrow anything.
Yeah.
Such a silly mindset.
Yeah. It's literally, man. It's a very limited thing. You know, it's like you can't save your way to retirement, right? Mm. You literally cannot save your way to retirement. You have to invest to retire.
Mm.
And one of the biggest vehicles that we have, it's leverage, right? Leverage is the biggest fulcrum that we have in property to go to the next level, to build what we can build. I look at myself and the low incomes that I was on, but my spending was so frugal. So even though I didn't make much, the banks would still lend me money, and that allowed me to leverage and build the portfolio. And being able to go through that and build the portfolio and keep growing, man, it's crucial. You and I wouldn't be sitting here today if I didn't leverage the banks and try and make as much as I could, which, again, wasn't heaps, but it allowed me enough that I could borrow the money from the banks and keep building the portfolio. So it's an absolutely critical piece of it. And yeah, you got to change the mindset around this. You should be trying to make as much as you can, declare as much as you can, so that you can then push the limits and borrow as much as possible.
You know what just jumped into my head then? When you were talking about that, it reminded me of when I came to start working with you.
Yes.
And my income that I was earning back then, early days, before you transitioned into the business, or before when you retired, or you were earning up to 100 grand.
Mm.
So in my business, I was earning more than that, maybe close to double that.
Yep.
But I had one property and you had 20 properties earning half. That's what really freaked my mind when we chatted. And I was like, how the hell has this guy built this? Because clearly you were focusing exactly what you said, whereas I had the complete opposite approach, trying to minimize the tax, not invest, save.
One of the cool things as well is like you can focus on this thing for a several year game plan. So like let's say you are on a high income, but you've been working on keeping it low and doing everything you can to kind of declare as little as possible, right? Even if you went out there and you went hyper-focused for the next 3 or 5 years on accumulation, and you just go, I'm going to make as much as I can, I'm going to pay as much tax as I need to, but I'm going to invest as hard as I can for the next 3 to 5 years. And all you do is pure accumulation. You sacrifice, you go absolutely laser focused on this thing and you build it out. In a 5-year window, how much you could build out, you could just sit there and then let the portfolio do its thing. Let it mature, consolidate when the right time to consolidate is. But after that, you know, whether you go 3, 4, 5 years, however long you want to do it for, after that point, you can go back to saving your tax and living off, you know, however you want to live from that side. But if you go down this other avenue and leverage hard during the period where you're making significant money, that's where the game, that, you know, you always talk about the rubber hitting the road. This is where this game-changing part comes in, which is leverage. And being able to leverage as much as possible comes down to being able to declare as much income as possible so the banks are happy to lend you that money. And this is where it's so crucial. We run into this all the time. People want to hold off. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to pay that considerable amount of tax, or they don't want to pay more tax than they need to, which I understand that. But the borrowing capacity is so important. If it is what allows you to get an extra deal a year over a 5-year window, just think of how much that could change your trajectory in life, as opposed to, I'm just going to save 10 grand this year in tax, or 20 grand or 50 grand, whatever it is this year in tax. If it's 50 grand a year in tax, you're going to be able to do more than one deal a year, right? It's a significant different amount. We're talking about 100 grand at the top margin. You know, but even if we're talking 10, 20s, that could be an extra deal or two a year for you. That stuff is life-changing. Saving 10 grand a year, 20 grand a year is not life-changing. Buying an extra property or two a year, that is life-changing.
Yeah. Mate, you said it very well. I think that's a great way to wrap it up. Mate, anything from you? Anything else?
Mate, we've been a bit loose today. We're at the very end. We're both a bit cooked. We smashed a couple of steaks. We've come back in. The Brazilian steaks, I think there was something in the rub. There was something going on.
Not enough rub.
But mate, thank you for joining me once again. I enjoyed the finance specific Q&A. It wasn't bad, mate. We're able to smash through, keep a bit of flow.
Maybe you should listen a bit more to some of the ideas I bring to the table.
I listen to them, I throw them in the bin because they're mostly shit.
Actually, if anyone's listening to this, if they've got a topic that they want us to focus on for the Q&A, make sure they write in because we'd love to listen and hear our
We actually
listeners.
Have a bit of a finance, very finance
focused
expert coming to the Live Summit, soon to be released on who that is. But if you're coming to the Live Summit, you should G up and get ready because there's someone pretty big coming in the finance space, and I think there'll be some very good takeaway points and some good lessons kind of from that side as well. So from a finance piece, guys, make sure from all pieces, right? Make sure you're getting to the Live Summit.
Can I add one last thing on this? Because what's just jumped out at me, every one of these questions, if you had the right broker in your corner, they would be able to guide you exactly what you should be doing at each of these points, because if they are an investment broker. So it just goes back to how important that person in your corner is.
Yeah.
Oh, same with the accountant when it comes to trust or whatever, or should you be doing this and that?
This is the thing, but when it comes down to your team, like your team is so important. If you're trying to do this thing by yourself and you're like haphazardly knocking around like I was at the start as well, like it's such a slow, laborious process. But when you get the right people in the team, you can execute at the right level and you can continue to build like that and you can lean on their expertise and their knowledge. It's unbeatable, man. You know, it's honestly unbeatable where you can kind of take this thing.
And this is the hardest part, I find.
Yeah. Yeah, building a team, 100%. Yeah,
getting everything ready, getting your documents, all that crap. It is the most laborious, boring, 100%. Pain in the ass bit.
But it's all part of the journey. Because realistically, the bank's lending you money. That leverage piece is the most powerful piece in property. Mm. And if you get that piece right and you go through the boring, annoying, pain in the ass that it is, that's how you leverage it. It's how you go to a different level.
You did well, Sammy. Weak start, but you finished strong. So congrats.
Weak start, weak middle, weak finish. Nothing new from you, mate. Thank you for coming up and joining us. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the potty. If there was anything in there that you think someone that you might know might take some great value out of, please make sure you send this episode onto them. We're always doing the chapters in these episodes as well, guys. So if there's anything in particular, make sure you shoot it over to someone and say, you got to listen to this chapter and this chapter or whatever it is. Or if you want to listen to the banter the whole way through, make sure they listen the whole way through. If you haven't left us a 5-star review yet, make sure you jump on there. You leave us a 5-star review. If you haven't hit subscribe, make sure you jump on there. We've got some big updates coming up, both on the Live Summit, School of Property, Australian Property Scout. There's heaps of updates and everything coming through, guys. So make sure you subscribe so you get through to every episode. Jimmy, any final words, mate?
No, that's it, mate. Well done.
Beautiful. Thank you, mate. Very well done to you as well. And listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. That's another episode of the Scouting Australia podcast.